From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the great jazz singer Abby Lincoln about why she only performs songs with lyrics she believes in. Also, after Arthur Ashe went public about having AIDS, he decided to write a memoir. He asked Arnold Rampersad to be the co-author. Rampersad had written a 2-volume biography of Langston Hughes. We'll talk with Rampersad about writing the new memoir. And linguist Jeff Nunberg comes to the defense of the much maligned expression, you know? That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. American AC-130 gunships are striking targets in Mogadishu at this hour, attacking positions near the headquarters of Somali faction leader Mohamed Farah Aidid. The UN struck Farah Aidid with 3 nighttime raids on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. A U.S. Cobra helicopter staged a daytime attack near Aidid's headquarters on Monday, but the UN has acknowledged that one missile from that attack went astray and hit a civilian neighborhood. The attacks are in retaliation for the killings of 23 Pakistani UN peacekeepers in an ambush that UN officials say was carried out by Aidid supporters. Bosnia's Muslim president Alija Izetbegovic walked out of peace talks with the leaders of Serbia and Croatia in Geneva today. Izetbegovic says he's not going to continue talks in the face of Serb attacks on the ground in Bosnia. The BBC's Peter Biles has details.
After more than 3 hours of discussions at a private villa just outside Geneva, the Bosnian president walked out, saying that he could not go on negotiating while the Bosnian-Serb bombardment of Garajda continued. But at a news conference, President Tudjman of Croatia said that Mr. Izetbegovic had agreed to proposals for a reworking of the Vance-Owen peace plan for Bosnia. It's now generally accepted that the plan will have to be amended. The international mediators are said to be open to suggestions. But the problem lies in finding consensus among all the warring parties, and at a time when the military situation on the ground in Bosnia is constantly changing. The leader of the Bosnian Serbs, Radovan Karadzic, said here in Geneva that the plan should be altered to allow for 3 ethnic mini-states in Bosnia. But that proposal is certain to be unacceptable to the Bosnian Muslims.
Peter Biles reporting from Geneva. The number of people claiming to find syringes and needles in Pepsi cans keeps growing. There are tampering reports in 23 states. Company and federal officials say many claims could be false. NPR's Laura Kanoy reports.
Pepsi's chief executive went on all 3 television networks today, saying the company's highly mechanized canning process makes it physically impossible to tamper with products at the plant. The company and the Food and Drug Administration believe some reports of syringes or needles found in Pepsi cans are false, and the FDA is investigating every claim. Pepsi spokeswoman Ann Ward.
There seems to be some phenomenon that when there's widespread publicity about an incident like this, there tends to be a lot of copycat, and there may be a lot of different reasons, maybe a perceived financial gain from it or just pranks. I'm sure it's a wide range of possibilities.
Meanwhile, more people report finding things in cans of Pepsi. A few grocery stores have pulled Pepsi from their shelves after complaints from customers. This is Laura Kanoy in Washington.
The Dow Jones Industrials gained 20 points today. This is NPR News. Senate Democrats succeeded today in cutting off a Republican filibuster against the campaign finance reform bill. The measure passed after senators came up with a compromise on a plan for taxpayer funding of congressional elections. The compromise was enough to bring some moderate Republicans on board and gain 2 votes more than the 60 needed to limit debate. Republican critics of the measure charged it would amount to a new entitlement program for politicians and could cost $540 million between 1996 and the year 2000. Leaders of Cambodia's main political factions have agreed to form an interim coalition that will rule Cambodia over the next 3 months. During that time, the Constituent Assembly, which was elected in last month's elections, will write a new constitution. NPR's Kay Magstad reports from Phnom Penh.
The feeling from both Funcinpec and the incumbent regime is that the compromise setup is not perfect, but it's something they can accept. The coalition proposed by head of state Prince Norodom Sihanouk makes his son, Funcinpec leader Prince Norodom Ranariddh, and incumbent Prime Minister Hun Sen co-chairman of the interim administration. Each of their parties will get 45% of the cabinet positions. The remaining 10% will go to a small Funcinpec-aligned party. Funcinpec had hoped to lead a new government, but the incumbent regime has made it clear that it would rather fight than lose power. Radical members of the regime attempted a short-lived secessionist movement this past week and then fled into Vietnam yesterday. Funcinpec appears to have gotten the message that the only way it's going to take power is to share with the losers. I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Phnom Penh.
There was more good news for the housing industry today as the government reported that housing starts were up by 2.4% in May and did even better than estimated the month before. The government revised its figures for April upward to 8.1%. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Abby Lincoln is one of the most emotionally gripping singers I know. That emotional depth comes through whether she's singing jazz standards or her own songs. Lincoln started her career in the 50s on the supper club circuit. She left that world after meeting the innovative drummer Max Roach, who she later married. In 1957, they made the first in a series of records together, which featured Lincoln backed by such jazz luminaries as Sonny Rollins and Eric Dolphy. Lincoln's songs began to reflect her growing involvement in the civil rights and Black Pride movements. Since 1990, she's recorded for Verve. From her latest album, this is the Frank Lesser song, Spring Will Be a Little Late This Year.
Spring will be a little late this year. A little late arriving in our lonely world over here, 'cause you have left us, and where is our April of old? You have left us. And winter continues cold, as if to say, spring.
Abby Lincoln, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell me why you wanted to record Spring Will Be a Little Late This Year.
I chose Spring Will Be a Little Late because it really is a brilliant song. It's wonderfully written, and it had the thought that I wanted bring to the album, one of the thoughts. It's something that I think a lot of people feel, a little disappointment and anxious for another time in our lives.
The song that we just heard is a standard, but in concert and on records, a lot of the songs that you sing are your own songs now.
Yes.
And I remember I interviewed you once a bunch of years ago, maybe 10 years ago, and I remember very clearly one of the things that you said. You said that at a certain point you stopped singing songs that had lines like "He beats me too" in it, because you felt that you lived the lyrics that you sang and that you couldn't afford to sing abusive lyrics like that anymore.
Yes, well, I know that Billie Holiday, I was following in her tradition, you know, and singing the songs that I'd heard her sing, and Dinah Washington and some of the other singers. But when I discovered that, as you said, a song is a prayer, and sometimes it's your own reality, and maybe it will be your reality in the future if you continue to sing it. I never experienced a relationship where a man beat me. And I thought, what am I singing this for? I don't want to live this, you know?
Mm-hmm. Let me play one of the songs that you wrote that you recorded on one of your recent albums. And this is called I've Got Thunder
Yes.
And It Rings. it's a great song.
Thank you.
Tell me something about writing it, about what you wanted to say about yourself in this song.
Well, there's a complaint about the woman, about the female, you know, especially about black women. I don't know. I guess it's the same thing for all the women. But if you express yourself, they say you talk too much and you don't know how to be feminine and you're a drag, you know. So I said, listen, this is all true. So run. Because I'm not changing anything. I'm everything that you say I am. So don't come around here. Because love is an emotion that'll move you to do things, to say things, and to be things, whether it pleases anybody or not.
Well, let's hear Abby Lincoln singing her own song, I've Got Thunder and It Rings. And this is from her album, The World is Falling Down.
Some folks talk about my power. Some folks say I'm wild and strong. Others say my style of living makes a man go wrong. I'm a woman hard to handle. If you need to handle things, better run. When I start coming, I got thunder and it rings. It'll move you to do things. Love is an emotion. It'll move you to do things. I got thunder and it rings. Some folks talk about the love they're feeling.
That's Abby Lincoln singing her own song. When you started your career as a singer, you worked as a glamorous nightclub singer, evening gowns, the whole bit. As a matter of fact, one writer described you as being packaged as the Black Julie London. Do you think that that's appropriate?
No, they used to compare me to Lena Horne. At that time, everybody was trying to be beautiful as Lena Horne.
Mm-hmm.
And there was Eartha Kitt, who was supposed to be a kitten. And you were supposed to have a glamorous image. And there was Marilyn Monroe. It was Marilyn. I wore a dress that they said she wore in a film called The Girl Can't Help It.
It was a rock and roll film.
Yeah, it was a fluke, really. And for the first time, I was using my physical look for... to attract attention to me, and it was a claim to fame. And it wasn't anything that I'd ever done before, because we were taught not to do that anyway. It's vanity. And so it was brought to me. It wasn't anything I thought of to do on my own. You know, some guys who were, who were very appreciative and ambitious for a career for me and thought, I could make a lot of money as a personality and as a singer, as long as I made peace with the fact that they said I couldn't sing.
Oh, they didn't like your singing?
They did. They told me I wasn't really a great singer at all. I just looked good, you know?
That's really funny.
It is. Now, but...
Right now.
Mm-hmm. But I suffered from it.
Well,
it caused some problems.
Did it make you insecure to have the people who were managing you think that you weren't very good at what you did?
Well, yes, it didn't help me any. I remember saying once to this beautiful man, he was a great songwriter and taught me a lot. And I said to him, you know, I have the feeling you people are robbing me of my individuality. He said to me, you don't have any individuality, but you will if you take direction. Well, he forgot who he was talking to, because he was one of the ones who told me that I could really think, and that he had all this admiration for me. But anyway, all of that is in the past. I wouldn't give up any of it, because I learned how to be whatever it is I am now.
Did it affect your relationship with men to be... sexy kitten on stage?
Because they believe, men and women, we all believe what we see on the screen. And people thought I was this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I played that role. Why would they think anything else? So I went from there to this warrior woman. And that befuddled everybody, too, because they thought, oh, why don't you shut up? I think I've had that said to me more than anything in the world over the years when I was younger. You talk too much. Shut up. You know, don't rock the boat. Even though they're miserable, people are miserable, they'll tell you this, but you're not supposed to say anything about it. So when I discovered that there was the world of the artist, it saved my life because I could strive to be individual and as best as I could be. I didn't have to have money. I didn't have to have anything except my life. And I went for that, and I'm glad I did.
How did you discover the world of the artist from the world of the supper club?
Max Roach had a lot to do with it. He wasn't the only artist I met, though, actually. There was Benny Carter, who I did my first album with, and Bob Russell, who named me Abby Lincoln, was a great artist and songwriter. But Max brought me to this music that they call jazz and introduced me to these great musicians and singers who I probably wouldn't have met, Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane. I didn't get a chance to meet Charlie Parker because he passed away before I got to New York City.
My guest is singer Abby Lincoln. She has a new album called Devil's Got Your Tongue. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I guess the singer Abby Lincoln. You said that when you discovered jazz in the world of the artist that you turned into a woman warrior.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about what you were like as the woman warrior then.
Well, the first thing I did, I just started to wear my hair natural. That was a crime in 1958. A black woman wasn't supposed to show that she had hair like she had. It was a disgrace to have this kind of hair that they call all these crazy names. So I just glorified my existence. And I said, this is me, and this is my beautiful self, you know? The beauticians thought I was going to ruin their business. They did. They said I was after their business, and a lot of people said things. And I started singing songs that were more social. I started writing songs. And I found songs that would express what was in my heart. Because, you know, Billie Holiday was like this. She didn't sing inane things. She sang about the life that she lived. She may have been masochistic and all these things, but she sang Strange Fruit. And God bless the child that's got his own. It's the same reason they remember Bessie Smith, because these were social singers. They weren't just, it wasn't self-aggrandizement, standing in front of people saying how great I am. But they were singing songs about the people's lives.
I want to play a recording that you made of a song very associated with Billie Holiday.
Yeah.
And it's a very masochistic song, Don't Explain. But it's a beautiful song, nevertheless, you know.
Yes, forgiving.
Yeah, and it's such a beautiful melody, and I love the way you sing it.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit before we hear it about the influence Billie Holiday had on you. I think you're a very different singer than she is, although I hear the influence that she's had on you. But tell me a bit about that influence, and also if you knew her, if you met her.
I met her when I was about 23 in Honolulu, and she came to the bar where I was working. It was probably to get away from where she was working, because the place was jammed with people. Anyway, she came to see me a couple of times, and I'd run to catch her show, and I saw her magic on the stage, this beautiful woman who would stand perfectly still with her hands, like she was like a doll, and her eyes would slide from one side of the room to the other, and the room was perfectly still. And I fell further in love with her. This was my, because I was singing a lot of songs that she sang already from that I learned on the radio, from the radio. But Billie Holiday was always honest. She didn't bend a note to make her voice sound good. It was in conversation that she sang. And she was sincere and honest, and she never made a record for money. She never raped anybody's career. And to me, she's the greatest singer of her era. I'm not the only one who feels this.
So do you think what you learned from Billie Holiday wasn't how to phrase as much as it was that you should be yourself?
Yes. Yes.
Let's hear your recording of Don't Explain, back from 1957, from your album That's Him, your first jazz recording.
Hush now, don't explain. Just say you'll remain. I'm glad you're back. Don't explain. Hush now, don't explain. You're my joy and pain. Skip that lipstick. Don't explain.
That's Abby Lincoln singing Don't Explain. You and Max Roach got married during the period that you were recording together.
Yes.
How did you like married life? And I'm wondering if your career ended up taking a back seat at all during
your
marriage.
No, he's a great artist and would never ask another artist to do that.
Uh-huh.
But marriage is the pit. You know why?
Why?
Because I'm a polygamous woman. I don't want him to be everything to a man. And I don't want him trying being everything to me. He's got his mother. I want to know if he loves his mother first. I want to know if he loves his first wife, if he got along with her or if he gets along with her. I just don't like this approach to marriage, and I will never do it again. I don't want to be that to anybody. I don't want anybody coming into my bedroom as if it's theirs. I have to have my own space, and I expect him to have his own. If he doesn't know how to have his own space, I don't want him around me.
So never again.
No, not that style.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. One of the songs of yours that you started singing when you began recording again in the late 70s was a song called Throw It Away. The lyric is about how you can throw something away because you can never lose a thing if it belongs to you.
I found this song. I used to throw the changes.
In the
I Ching, yeah. Oscar Brown Jr. introduced me to this oracle. So... And one day I threw this change and I heard this thought. So I just wrote it. I elaborated on it and wrote it.
Were you thinking of things that you thought you had thrown away?
But we all have to throw things away, you know? I had thrown away my marriage, my career, everything. Because this is the way it is. And we eventually you have to throw your body away. You die and you can't take it with you. So there's nothing here that really belongs to us hardly, except for work. I know that is mine. Your children are not even yours. There's very little that belongs to us in this world. And a song is mine. If 100 years from today, if anybody hears the song, they'll know that I wrote it. So I figure those are the things that are mine. And not somebody.
When you sing now, do you feel comfortable on stage?
Yes. For many years, it's the most comfortable thing in the world to do. I'm not nervous. I'm not scared. I come to do something, to say something, and it's my first nature.
On the liner notes of one of your early records, someone quotes Thelonious Monk as having said to you the first time he saw you sing, "I like the way you stand."
No, he never said anything like that to me. Thelonious Monk wouldn't say anything like that to anybody in the first place. He doesn't give a damn about the way you stand. Excuse me, Lord. Thelonious Monk said to me, after listening to the words that I had written to his song, Blue Monk, he said to me, he came to where I was and whispered in my ear, don't be so perfect. And I said to Max Roach, you know, Thelonious said to me, he said, don't be so perfect. What did he mean? And Roach said, he means make a mistake. And I didn't know what either one of them were talking about.
So how do you interpret that now?
It means that you must reach for something. You have to reach for the sky. If you don't make it, at least you reached for it. So your voice cracked, but you reached for it. You don't play safe. It's not safe, Jones. You take a chance on making a mistake. That's what they meant. And I do. I've learned to sing like that. Because I'm the human being. And even if it doesn't work, it's not wrong. If I didn't achieve what I meant to, it's okay. It's all right, because, I mean, I tried for it. Yeah.
Well, I just saw you sing in Philadelphia a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And it was a great performance.
Thank you.
And I don't know, it seems like when I see you on stage that you really are feeling the material that you sing. You're not falling back on professionalism or show business or anything. You seem to really be reaching inside each time you perform.
That's true. It's the way of the music. Thelonious Monk would be drenched in perspiration and absolutely possessed. Nina Simone, Billie Holiday, and Charlie Parker, even though I didn't see him, but I hear it in his music. It's a possession. It's the muse. They talk about the muse. I'm possessed of a muse, and I belong to her, and she belongs to me. And as long as I sing and I am real and I do nothing to betray the trust, this is what I do. And it's a wonderful experience to come to the stage and to know that everything is all right.
It sounds like you think that if you betrayed the trust of your muse, that your muse would abandon you.
Yes, they do. They don't need anybody. They can sing whistle around the corner. They can babble in the brook. They don't need anybody. If you don't come real, they don't come and visit you. They come to visit sincerity and innocence and that one. You have to have this spirit yourself. To know that we are great people, and this is part of our life, this is part of our spirit, music. And to sing with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind, the way they do in the churches. That's where Aretha Franklin came from, where they sing for the reverence of the gods that they choose to worship. I didn't come from the church, and I see God through my mother and my father and my relatives. And when I come to the stages with reverence for myself, for my life.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Abby Lincoln, her new album's called Devil's Got Your Tongue. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Long ago, falling shadows sent you on the run, and you learned to hide and sneak, running from the sun. Many, many things have changed, many songs were sung, but today it's sad to say the devil's got your tongue. Dancing with the devil, quiet as it's kept, in a new direction, around a turn of step.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Shortly before he died, Arthur Ashe wrote a memoir about the last chapter of his life and his reflections on AIDS, racism, sports, and family. He asked Arnold Rampersad to co-author the book. Rampersad had written a biography of Langston Hughes. Ashe's memoir has just been published, and coming up, we'll talk with Arnold Rampersad about collaborating with Ashe. And if you sprinkle your speech with the phrase, you know, watch out. Everyone from politicians to linguists will criticize you for using the expression. Linguist Jeff Nunberg wonders why. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Pentagon officials have confirmed that what was termed a UN operation is underway again in Somalia. According to CNN, U.S. planes have taken part in another attack on the headquarters of a Somali clan leader. According to the network, it was a brief attack, and it appears its target was not Mohammed Adid, but his assets. Earlier today, military officials said that four U.S. ships, with more than 4,000 sailors and Marines on board, were heading toward the coast of Somalia after cutting short a military exercise in Kuwait. The troops are to be on standby in case they are needed. On Capitol Hill, the House is debating the Foreign Aid Authorization Bill for 1994. Members defeated an amendment today to cut aid funds for Russia. NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
Arizona Republican John Kyle proposed the cut because he said Russia had as much aid as it could deal with.
With all of this money already in the pipeline, why should we be authorizing an additional $700 million when the head of the IMF says we can't get that money to them because they don't have the cooperation necessary between the different parts of their government to effectively utilize these funds?
Earlier today, President Clinton defended his Russian aid package, saying it would lead to joint ventures with U.S. businesses and a continued effort by Russia to dismantle its nuclear weapons. Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Lee Hamilton warned cutting aid would be a blow to Clinton and other Western leaders and a setback for Russian President Boris Yeltsin. There were plenty of congressional complaints about providing foreign assistance while cutting domestic spending. But when it came to a vote on the Russian aid package, the House let it stand. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela has warned that democracy talks will continue with or without conservative delegates who walked out of yesterday's meeting. Mandela spoke today at a ceremony on the anniversary of the 1976 Soweto uprising. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
The ANC sponsored dozens of public meetings today, marking the 17th anniversary of the day police opened fire on student protesters in Soweto. The riots that followed in 1976 eventually left hundreds dead and generated international outrage against the apartheid regime. Mandela said today's Soweto commemoration should be the last under white minority rule.
No force on earth will be able to prevent the holding of the first one-person, one-vote elections in our beloved country.
Negotiators have tentatively set next April 27th as the date for elections. Several parties protested that date yesterday, but most are expected to be back at the talks tomorrow. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 19 points. This is NPR News. Senate Democrats have apparently reached agreement on a deficit-cutting plan. Under the proposal, the controversial BTU tax would be replaced by a higher tax on motor fuels. The agreement clears the way for the full Senate Finance Committee to act on the measure tomorrow or Friday. All nine Republicans on the panel are expected to oppose it. The proposal also reportedly calls for more cuts in Medicare spending. In Moscow, Russia's Constitutional Conference has completed the first stage of its work, with the adoption of the basic principle by which Russia will be governed. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
The declaration adopted by the Constitutional Conference today commits Russia to upholding the human rights of its citizens and the protection of private property and free enterprise. It also declares that the federal government of Russia must rest on a clear separation of powers among the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of government. The declaration specifies that Russia must have a two-chamber parliament, which would eliminate the old Soviet-style Congress of People's Deputies. This is not a constitution yet, just a list of those constitutional principles that the conference has so far agreed on. Among the continuing points of contention are the relative powers of the president and parliament, and the issue of equal status of Russia's various autonomous republics and territorial regions. After a 10-day break, the constitutional conference is scheduled to resume its work. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
After failing twice, the Senate has broken a Republican deadlock over campaign financing, thus clearing the way for major changes in the way political candidates raise and spend money. Several moderate Republican senators joined Democrats to limit debate on the measure. The bill would allow public financing only to compensate candidates who comply with voluntary spending limits, while their opponents exceed the ceilings. The money would come from a new 34% tax on the campaign committees of candidates who exceed spending limits. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up against other major foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Arthur Ashe didn't want the public to know he had AIDS, but last year when he found out a newspaper had the story, he decided to announce it first. Then he decided to write a memoir, which he asked Arnold Rampersad to co-author. That new memoir, Days of Grace, has just been published, 4 months after Ashe's death. It includes his reflections on AIDS, racism, tennis, and family. We invited Arnold Rampersad to read an excerpt of the book and talk with us about collaborating with Ashe. Rampersad is a professor of literature at Princeton University, the author of a 2-volume biography of Langston Hughes, and the editor of the unexpurgated works of Richard Wright. Here's Arnold Rampersad reading from Ashe's new memoir.
After my AIDS announcement on April 8, 1992, I was angry for several days. But when my wife Jeannie and I had to tell our daughter, Camera, of my illness, I swallowed my feelings and put on a dispassionate face. "Precious," I asked her that evening when Jeannie and I decided the time had come, "have you noticed anything unusual lately at home?" "Yes," she said. "What?" "The telephone," she replied, not looking up from my computer, which she was using. "They keep ringing all the time." "Yes, do you know why?" "They are ringing because Daddy had to go on television and tell everybody that he is sick, that he has AIDS." "What's AIDS?" she asked, looking at me now. "Is it like when you have diarrhea? When you don't feel well in the morning? Is that AIDS?" Her instincts surprised Jeannie and me. She knew more, had noticed and associated more than we had ever suspected. 5 years old, she could understand only a small part of what we said, but we talked to her as best we could about the illness. We also tried to prepare her for the taunts of classmates and other children. "Camera, what are you going to say to anybody who tells you your daddy has AIDS?" "What should I say?" she asked. "Just say, 'Oh, I know that.'" We hoped that this simple reply would stop the teasing. We were sure that Camera would master this response easily. After all, like it was for almost every child of her age, "I know that" had become her spontaneous reply to almost anything said to her, even if she didn't have a clue about it. But this piece of information, that her father suffered from AIDS, she would indeed have, and her knowledge would save her from hurt. Or so we hoped.
That's Arnold Rampersad reading from Arthur Ashe's new autobiography, Days of Grace. And Arnold Rampersad co-wrote the memoir with Arthur Ashe. Arnold Rampersad, how did Arthur Ashe choose you to write his final memoir with him?
Well, I don't know all the ideas that went into his decision, but he called me in June of last year and said that he wanted to do a book about race and politics, his views on those matters, and also about AIDS and heart disease and the last, 10 years of his life. And was I interested? And I immediately said I was very much interested. He had read something I had written, perhaps more than one book, The Life of Langston Hughes, I think he had read, and he decided that he did not want a sports writer on this particular book because it would only be in part about sports, so he asked me.
He approached you after the public knew that he had AIDS.
Yes, the public knew in April. He approached me in June.
Did you both feel that you were racing against the clock because of AIDS?
Arthur never let on that he was racing against the clock. I don't know if he felt that he was or not. I know that I felt a sense of urgency, not because he was deteriorating before my eyes, but I knew enough about AIDS to know that it is an imperious disease, and and could take him at any time. I felt very much that, that the clock was against us.
How did that affect how you worked together?
Well, it meant that I dropped everything else, so I'm currently answering letters sent to me several months ago. We worked intensely, long sessions. Arthur could stand being interviewed for about 2 hours, 2.5 hours, before his stamina began to give out, and we did that as often as we could through the summer, July, August, September, October, November, transcribed the interviews. And we had to be in touch with one another all the time. And then when the project moved to the writing stage, we had to be in touch with one another and with our editor at Knopf, Jonathan Siegel, a lot of the time, much more so, much more intensely than I think we would have ordinarily done so.
What did you each want this book to be?
That's a good question. Arthur, I think, set out wanting a book that dealt primarily with race and politics. He was deeply disturbed by the state of American culture in our time. He was even more disturbed by the state of African-American culture, if you can separate the two things in our time, and he wanted to concentrate on that. I, with the instincts, the snoopy instincts of a biographer, perhaps, wanted to know more about Arthur as a person. I believed also coolly from a distance that the book would achieve its greatest power through a blending of the objective and the subjective, through a revelation of Arthur's ideas about the world, but also a revelation of Arthur Ashe in a more intimate way. At first, I think he resisted the second dimension, but I think as we went along, he came to embrace it. And in fact, one day he did say to me, at the end of a long session, everyone with a terminal disease should have to go through this. This is great.
You said he really at first wanted his memoir to be a book about race in America and his views on certain issues pertaining to race, and you wanted to make the book more personal. Were there personal issues in his life that related to the larger issues of race that he wanted to discuss? Were you urged him to bring out those personal issues?
Well, I can't think of many offhand, but there is one section in the book where he talks about the incident of the dolls. I call it the Valley of the Dolls to his, to his face, where he goes to the U.S. Open and Stan Smith, the great tennis player, his daughter brings Camera a doll as a present, and the doll is blonde. And Arthur is aware that national television is on, cameras are on the family and on his daughter playing with a blonde doll. And he's aware, he says, I know that evening my phones would be running off the hook from people who would criticize me because my daughter has a blonde doll. And this is in the context, too, of the 1954 Supreme Court decision where black children playing with white dolls was used to show a lack of self-esteem and so on. So he asks his wife, Jeannie, to help get rid of the dolls quietly. Then he's upset that he has interfered in this way. Has he done the moral thing? He just saw a day that was supposed to be a glorious day. This was the an exhibition put on to help the AIDS Foundation, in which all the wonderful young tennis players, had come out. This day was being blighted by the specter of race, by his misgivings, by his anticipation of there's no possibility of natural action in this world that is so tainted, so distorted by race. That is an example of the way in which an incident in his life relates to a larger issue.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Arnold Rampersad. He co-wrote with Arthur Ashe the memoir Days of Grace, which has just been published. And we're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Arnold Rampersad is my guest. He's the author of an acclaimed two-part biography of Langston Hughes. He co-wrote Arthur Ashe's new memoir, Days of Grace. Ashe approached Rampersad and asked him to co-write it. Arnold Rampersad, could I ask you to read the very first few lines of Days of Grace?
Certainly. If one's reputation is a possession, then of all my possessions, My reputation means most to me. Nothing comes even close to it in importance. Now and then I have wondered whether my reputation matters too much to me, but I can no more easily renounce my concern with what other people think of me than I can will myself to stop breathing. No matter what I do, or where or when I do it, I feel the eyes of others on me, judging me.
Why did you decide to start the memoir with that thought?
Well, that's an excellent question. I thought it was the essence of Arthur Ashe. I thought he was a man who lived in the public eye at all times. He lived an exemplary life. I think he was aware he was living it. There is a danger there, of course. Danger is that you can be a hypocrite, or you can be so dictated to by public opinion that you are nothing but a shadow of a human being. But no, not with Arthur. I mean, I think Arthur saw himself in the context of a family and the context of a community, whether that community was first simply the blacks of Richmond or the blacks of the Westwood district of Richmond, where with which he was very familiar as a child. But he always saw himself living in the real world with other groups of people, and he was always aware of them watching him.
As a man who was very concerned about his reputation, was there anything in this book that he wanted to set the record straight about? Things about which he felt he had been misunderstood?
Well, I think there are various things. I don't know if anything is earth-shattering. I mean, one thing he did speak about was the supposition that that there would be people who would assume that because he had AIDS, he probably was gay and had picked up AIDS in some clandestine meeting somewhere. And he wanted to set that record straight, not because he's a homophobe or anything like that, simply because he wanted the truth to be known, the truth being, and he was proud of it, even though it made him seem to some people a little old-fashioned. He'd never had an affair outside of marriage in his 16 years of marriage, and he had never had a homosexual experience, he said. He tried to set the record straight on that issue. Other matters don't come so readily to mind. I mean, he did want to talk about his relationship to radicalism in the 1960s when he was developing his skills as a tennis player. I don't think, I mean, he understood that he could not have really married those two areas, conquests on the tennis court and also displays of radical political activity. I think he felt a certain amount of guilt. He himself said that he felt a sense of shame even back in the 60s, knowing that he was not on the barricades when people were putting their lives on the line. And I think he was eager now to talk about that, particularly because for much of the time he has acted as if it had not mattered that much to him. I think he wanted that to be known. I think if you had to sum it up, you would say that he was prepared at this point to talk about himself more in terms of fragility and indecisiveness than he had been in the past. I say indecisiveness only because he was always trying to make the right decision, the moral decision, the decision that would agree with what he had been taught was right when he was growing up. He never wanted to harm anybody. I once said to him, "Have you ever been? How do you feel about having been mean to people in the past?" And he said, "I've never been mean to anyone." And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and he stared me down. He had never been mean to anybody as far as he was concerned. That's the way he had lived his life. But in spite of that, I mean, there was that element of fragility there that I hoped the book would bring out, because I thought it was a very, very important part of his personality and his personal history.
The first part of the memoir deals with Arthur Ashe's decision to go public with the fact that he had AIDS, and he made that decision knowing that if he didn't go public, it was going to be published in USA Today. You probably observed that period of his life on television and in the newspapers, you know, through press conferences and articles and so on. Did the story seem very different to you when you were actually writing it with Arthur Ashe than it looked to you when you were observing it with the rest of the American public?
Let me just say that the that it was not absolutely certain that USA Today was going to publish the story, but Arthur felt the heat was on and that somebody would publish it sooner or later.
Well, they had the story and they'd called him about it.
Yes.
And he urged them not to publish it, and he wouldn't exactly confirm it, although he didn't deny it.
Absolutely.
But it was probably just a matter of time until somebody published it.
Absolutely. You're quite right. I think I sometimes wondered whether Arthur finally was glad that the story broke, that he broke the story. Certainly he was very angry when he did break the story and remained angry for a while, as he himself says in the book. When I look back on it, I see how glorious his life was from certain aspects, points of view in the last few months of his life, what wonderful opportunities he had to talk to people, to teach about AIDS, to influence others, to have his example seen and recognized. I think that from my point of view, it probably was a good thing. I think that he might have looked at it differently still. He had 9 months left of his life. He didn't know that. And perhaps he would have liked to have spent it, you know, in peace and obscurity. But when I think of how much he wanted to make a difference, I can't help thinking that perhaps this was best for all concerned, finally.
How close did you both get? Or are you the kind of person who almost likes to keep a distance from somebody who you would be writing about?
No, I think Arthur could not. I don't think Arthur could have made, or anyone in his position could have made, new friends at that point of his life. But I think I wanted to be closer to Arthur. There's no doubt about that. I mean, I had to keep a distance in order to take his measure. I could not contribute much to the book if I wasn't looking at him objectively and knowing what to bring forward and what to push back and what to emphasize and what to de-emphasize. But I definitely wanted to know him more intimately. And it really was not possible. I could not say at the end of it that Arthur and I had become great friends. That's not true at all. Arthur had many, many, many friends. I was not really one of them. I wasn't brought in to be his friend. I was brought in to help him get out this last story of his life. I miss him, you know, dearly. And I hope I have, given back to him some of what he gave to me by involving me in this story.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Arnold Rampersad co-wrote the new Arthur Ashe memoir, Days of Grace. Rampersad is a professor of literature at Princeton University. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll have the latest on the progress of President Clinton's economic program on Capitol Hill. Also, what's new with campaign finance reform. A talk with one of the corporate CEOs who had lunch with President Clinton at the White House today. And a special report on today's program by Lynn Neary about racism. And what do we mean by racism? Lynn interviewed a number of people, black, white, Asian, and asked them what racism is and what they think other people understand by the term. It's a very interesting report. Also today, we'll be hearing about the election in Malawi, the referendum to introduce multi-party rule there.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Not long ago, Senator Robert Byrd rose on the floor of the Senate to deliver a speech deploring the expanding use of the expression, you know. He said, the phrase betrays a mind whose thoughts are so disorganized as to be unutterable, a mind in neutral gear connected to a tongue stuck in overdrive. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg wants to know why so many critics are ganging up on this little expression.
Of course, there are you knows and you knows, and most of them are useful linguistic citizens. There's the you know of self-revelation, as in, you know, I've never engaged in this kind of thing before. There's the you know of remonstrance, as in, you know, you're not the only one with angst. And there's the you know that announces a sudden insight, as in, you know, these things would go great with cream cheese and lox. But the you know that bothers critics is something else again. It's the one you stick in the middle of a sentence when words fail you and you want to throw yourself on the mercy of the context. Oh, but George is, you know, kind of weird about opera. As if to say, I'm not putting this with as much accuracy as precise communication might require, but I'm counting on you to cut me a little slack here. Used in moderation, it's a harmless enough little noise. And sometimes it can be a useful way of nodding to the informality of the context, a reminder that friends don't expect friends to spell everything out for them. I grant you that some people overdo this in an annoying way. But it's not clear why the problem should be worth 20 minutes on C-SPAN, or why Edwin Newman should call, you know, one of the most far-reaching and depressing developments of our time. I mean, even allowing for overstatement, that's quite a claim to make in an age that's given us linguistic innovations like incentivize and ethnic cleansing. As it happens, in fact, there's nothing particularly new about the phrase. It's true that you don't run across it much in Melville or James, but then this isn't the kind of expression that writers would have set down in the cleaned-up dialogue of novels. If you went strictly by the literary evidence for that matter, you'd probably conclude that nobody ever said before 1947. Still, there's evidence that you know was in wide use in American speech 100 years ago. And anyway, before it was you know, it was something else. People have always had their conversational tics and twitches. The difference is that critics didn't used to take public notice of this kind of language before. For all we know, Benjamin Disraeli was positively phobic about the overuse of I say, but it's for sure he never got up in the House of Commons to deliver a speech about it. What's different now is that conversation isn't just a private affair. It's become the chief vehicle of entertainment and public information. Last year's presidential campaign simply made official what has been true for 20 or 30 years. We've become a society of overhearers. From dawn to midnight, you could spend every minute of the day listening to other people schmooze. They're schmoozing with Phil and Oprah, with Larry King, with Bill Moyers, with Jay and Arsenio. George Bush is schmoozing with Barbara Walters, and then Barbara and Hugh Downs are schmoozing about that. And the conversation of these shows is a strange new form of discourse. It's a familiar colloquy between people who may never have met before, where the real audience is only acknowledged in the third person. Well, Barbara, your viewers might not realize. Now, in this simulated intimacy, there's no real common ground to appeal to. So those fillers like you know that pass unnoticed in ordinary conversation can suddenly strike us as oddly jarring. The professional interviewers and talk show hosts appreciate this, of course. They may use a you know now and again, but always with a certain amount of artifice. It's a way of implying intimacy without really being intimate, the way the set of Good Morning America implies a living room without actually being one. But you can see how the callers or the guests might not get this right and might start talking to the host as if they really were alone with somebody that they were really on a first-name basis with. Yeah, but Larry, it's like lots of people are, you know, out of work. I can see why all of a sudden language critics have started to notice you know. I have to say that it bothers me, too, but only when I hear it over the air. You want to say to these callers, look, we've never met you. We don't know.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist associated with Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. Our intern is Devin Reif. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Scientists believe a new strain of virus is causing the mysterious illness in the Southwest. A virus may also be behind the mysterious new illness in Cuba. What's happening in the world of viruses? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Yale epidemiologist Robert Shope. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.